The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
There may or may not be drunken cannibals out in the middle of the Oklahoma
Prairie. That's like awesome. A whole other side story. That's for the sequel, right? PK Boys 2.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It is director and co-writer of a movie called Ike Boys, Eric McEver. Eric, welcome.
Hi. Konnichiwa. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, well, yeah, we love talking to filmmakers, and you're probably one of our first who has a movie at a festival, but maybe you don't have distribution yet, right?
All kinds of things are in works at the moment. So I feel like if you ask me, I'm 90% sure that if you were to ask me that question in a few days or a few weeks, I would have a very detailed answer. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, the answer is TBA.
TBA. Yeah, all right.
That's awesome.
The movie has just played. It was, by the time we get this recording out, it will have just played at Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas. When you were standing in and watching this with an audience, how did it go?
Well, it was a really, I guess the feeling I would describe as validation, because the film creatively was a real swing for the fences, in that I knew there was a version of this film that would be cute and jokey and ironic and too cool for school. Right. And I thought, well, I could make that film and it would achieve some degree of success, or I could do the film I really believe in, made with heart and sincerity, and know that mean-spirited people and ironic people would have a field day with it, but it would ultimately reach the people that mattered. So I cast the die and swung for the fences, and it was a risk, but I think the sense I got last night, the really palpable sense, was everyone was just really engaged and 100% got what I was going for with the, you know, with the sincerity, with the, you know, and I don't want to overstate this, because there's a lot of humor in the film. There's a lot of funny stuff and a lot of ridiculous stuff. But I made sure it all came from a real place, and the audience seemed to, without blinking an eye, fully understand that. So I'm honored. I'm delighted. I'm feeling a sense of peace.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that is an interesting thing. This isn't a wink wink type of thing, even though you have a lot of references to, especially, I guess, Jonathan and I and Tatum's childhoods and everything. I imagine you're probably around our age. I don't know. I'm 44. So
I'm 35.
35. So you're way younger then. Don't worry about it.
Although, if I might insert there, one of the wonderful things I've discovered in my career so far is how a shared love of these stories, it's kind of an age flattener. I've met people much older than me who, it's just the moment we connect, it's like suddenly we're all around age 12. And it seems like these stories and these films, good people make them and they bring good people together. You talk about don't meet your heroes, but that has absolutely not been the case for me. Like, the heroes I have met are now my friends, and it's felt like traveling across the world to look in a mirror. So I don't know. That's one of the bigger and more meaningful rewards of this whole journey.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
So I mean, it's probably a pretty obvious question, but because people don't exactly know what this movie's about yet during this podcast at this point in time, what was your inspiration for this movie?
Well, my own life, honestly. So this is my first. So technically, it's my fifth feature film, but the first one was in high school, and the other three were self-financed in Japan. Were, you know, I'm proud of them. They're practice movies, but mm-hmm. made with a lot of passion, and I stand by them. But this is the first one that it's, you know, it's meant to reach a wide audience. It's meant to make money. It's meant to, you know, it is a real movie. And, you know, it was important to me that it be something. There's so many movies made. It had to be something that really mattered. And I got the same advice in different words from different sources. And I think maybe the best way that it was articulated was the Duplass brothers, who said, you know, make a film that you are uniquely qualified to make. I thought about that a lot, and I thought, well, what do I really believe? What do I really care about? And how could I combine those things? And, you know, the answer kind of became obvious once I started going there. It's like, well, I grew up fascinated with these stories from Japan. They led me to Japan and, you know, my dearest friends in life. The goal of this film is to make the kind of film that when people have just had a really awful day, they will turn to it for a pick-me-up, and then, you know, it's like, oh, I've watched DK Boys. I feel better. And my thinking was, well, the only way I can earn an audience's trust to watch my film in a vulnerable moment, I mean, if that's really my goal, I need to make myself vulnerable to the audience. And I thought, well, let me just be as honest with my own personal story as possible, because they say specificity is universal.
Yeah.
I really bored down on that, and then, you know, surrounded myself with more talented, more experienced people to elevate that.
Mm-hmm. And this is a loaded question, but it seems apt, because, you know, there's so many different, it looks like there's so many different things that you were inspired by, that you put into this movie. So like anime, comic books, TV shows, movies, cartoons. Could you name off some of those that were really big for you and that sort of went into this movie?
Sure. I will give my answer, but I think one of the goals of the film is to make something that would be a sort of a mirror for people who, you know, the touchstones that we all have might be a little bit different, but I wanted to make mm-hmm. a movie that would speak to the different, you know, range of stories out there. So when I was really like in kindergarten, I'm one of those kids who had a dinosaur phase and never grew out of it to this day. But at like age 4 or 5, there aren't many dinosaur films that are safe to show to a kid. So mm-hmm. not knowing what they were unleashing upon the world, my parents showed me Showa era Godzilla films. Mm-hmm. And I loved them, and it triggered a lot of things inside me in terms of, you know, curiosity about the wider world, about other countries, about other languages. Mm-hmm. And when I was a little bit older, I discovered that there were new Godzilla films being made in the 90s in Japan. And through dubious means, I will say, don't worry, I have since bought it legally. through dubious means, I tracked down 1994's Godzilla versus Space Godzilla,
and this was
around age 10, and it just it was a transformational moment because it was new and it was exciting and it was a whole other world, and that kind of opened the floodgates. I would say in terms of filmmaking, in terms of something that I've come back to since. The Heisei Gamera trilogy by Kaneko Shusuke.
Yeah.
That was really revelatory for me. And Kaneko, he's actually one of the producers in the opening of DK Boys. So you talk about meeting your heroes. That is an honor, to put it mildly. As well as special effects for the trilogy, Higuchi Shinji, He's the narrator in the cursed anime. And so talking about Higuchi-san, that brings us to, of course, Evangelion, which I discovered that, you know, it's interesting because the lead character in that's 14, and I discovered it around age 15. And couldn't have been a more perfect time to experience that, because it really showed me, wow, you know, here's a really authentic, like real raw story about what it means to grow up, mixed with all of these just really compelling, you know, genre elements and mythological elements and religious elements. And, you know, it's probably no accident that I saw that at age 15. And then I made my own film where it's a coming of age story mixed with apocalyptic imagery. And, so those were the big ones, but you know, there's so many, it's such a rich library, and part of the joy of it is that I keep discovering them. I mean, I hesitate to even call this anime, but just a few years ago, the Tale of Princess Kaguya, I mean, I think that's just showing the new frontier in what cinema can be. So, you know, there's the influences that I had growing up, but you keep getting influenced and you keep growing. So it's all fed in.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk a little bit about your cast here, because, you know, especially the three, principals here. And then of course, surprise, Billy Zane is in this movie, you have, and I'm sorry if I mess up names, but you have Quinn Lord, you have Ronak Gandhi, and you have Christina Higa, that round out the three that, get involved in this, that, you know, it's funny hearing you talk about getting Godzilla, through dubious means and everything. And I don't know if it was necessarily dubious means, that the main character, well, you know, one of the main characters, Sean, gets his hands on this DVD that's like, you know, it's a legendary movie that no one has seen in forever or whatever, but. I did like that little animation at the beginning too, where, like, you know, like people are making out in the theater and yep. you know all that, and it was a lot of fun. But how did you come about this cast? What was the process like?
Yeah, well, all of them are wonderful. And by the way, you got the pronunciation almost completely correct. Ronak will be pissed at me if I don't correct. It's Ronak as in knuckle.
Ronak. So, okay.
Ronak, I'm doing your due diligence for you, buddy.
yeah.
So, you know, what was really important for me, and, you know, and this speaks to all the things I've been saying at the film, is that I work with actors who brought truth and authenticity to their characters. And so what it came down to was finding actors who I had a genuine chemistry with as a person, and who we had a genuine chemistry together as a group, so that it would, working together, it would be a relaxed space where real authentic characters who were, like, they were real people, they weren't ideas of people, would emerge. And the real gift of this is, you know, the four of us just, like, get along like gangbusters. But I've got my own unique relationship with all three of them, and I think that's really why it turned out so well. You know, so there's a story. So Quinn is playing a character loosely based off of me, and for me, this is just a case study in why destiny is a real thing and why there are certain people who you are meant to connect with in life. Because Quinn, basically, Quinn and I are the same person, and it's, you know, and it's in cute little funny ways. Like, he and I can have an entire conversation that consists entirely of Farscape quotes.
Oh God,
nice.
More recently, our more recent code will be speaking entirely in Toast of London quotes. you know, since filming, I mean, it's been many, we've just had many Zoom sessions where we've just, like, played chess and talked. And I think Quinn is, he's one of those people who, he lacks pretenses in that he is true to himself, and he feels no need in, like, no shame and no need to be what someone else thinks he should be. He's just a sweet, authentic, sincere person. And so it's very easy to connect with someone like that. Mm-hmm. And so Ronak is, he plays a character who's loosely based off of my best friend in high school. And Ronak is, it's neat because he and I have a similar chemistry to that friendship. You know, Ronak is a big, like, larger than life personality. He's goofy. He's colorful, and all of that is on the surface over, the best way to describe it would be a deep emotional intelligence. I mean, he's one of the most empathetic people I know. And so there's very much whereas Quinn and I are kind of like, we're both on one side of the coin. Ronak is on the other side. And so we balance one another out very well there. And then the thing I can say about Christina is, so we basically had the same inverted life journey. Whereas I grew up in Oklahoma and studied Japanese and worked very hard to get to Japan and live there, Christina grew up in Tokyo and she went to an international school. And actually English is her first language.
Really?
And so I don't want to speak out of turn here, but I think it's fair to say that she, spent her childhood trying to find who she was and her place in the world. And that led to coming to America and studying there and, finding herself through music and now through acting. By the way, she does the end credits song in the film. She's
very cool.
And so, if you talk about traveling overseas to find yourself, that's a story that both Christina and I can relate to, but that is certainly Miki's story. And so, it's, I think really what it came down to is all of us, we're just able to be ourselves around one another and just having that complete lack of pretenses and lack of walls and unnecessary barriers means that we were able to craft real people on screen.
They seem like it. I mean, they really do seem like people that, you dealt with in high school. If you were in that group, I mean, obviously you're either in that group or you're in the bully group or, whatever.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, I was never a part of the bully group, and I was, I guess, halfway in the nerd group, but it was a weird thing. So whatever, but go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and they just felt like kids, right? I mean, I was curious. I mean, I looked up some of the ages. I saw Quinn was like, I think he's like 20, 21 or whatever. But I mean, but they felt like teenagers. They felt like kids that age, and they were doing things that, in a crazy situation like this, like, I felt like they were acting like any normal, any kid would if that crazy stuff happened to them, right? So I thought that always helps, I think, gets the movie a little more realism in the face of, the fantasy and stuff, which is really cool.
Well, thank you, because that was absolutely the goal. And there's a lot of humor in the film, but I wanted to be sure that, they say the great comedy tells the truth. And I wanted the humor to come from the fact that, oh, yeah, these kids with, their limited experiences and resources, this is what they would do. These are the harebrained schemes that would emerge in this kind of predicament. Yeah. So thank you. I'm glad that was your takeaway.
Mm-hmm. And I love seeing Quinn, by the way. I'm a huge Trick or Treat fan. So, nice. He's nice. Become such a horror icon, right? I mean, I think people dress up as him for Halloween and stuff. So I guess that counts.
he is aware, very aware of and very honored by his role there.
That's very cool.
He's excited by the possibility of having at least two iconic characters to his name now.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I can feel it. It's going to happen again.
Yeah.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I had a question. You have already answered. Are you from Oklahoma? But so tell me about the importance of setting this movie in your home state, because you're probably a lot like, you know, like I always find it, awesome whenever someone puts Tennessee or Nashville in there, because that's where we're from.
Yeah.
It feels like a lot of filmmakers go out and they make their movie and they're like, well, I guess I got to make this in New York or LA or something. And then, you know, they hardly ever get a chance to do their hometown. You know, like, I guess everybody would like to be like Alexander Payne and set their, you know, their movie in Nebraska every time if they wanted to. But how important was that to you to have the setting in Oklahoma?
Well, it was very important. It was a mixture of inspiration and necessity. And I think the happy thing is that they kind of, ultimately, they dovetailed. The inspiration side of it was, you know, as a child, I was bored out of my skull. And that was part of, like, what led to the interest in Japan and the wider world out there. Mm-hmm. And I got to Japan, and now I've lived there for many years. And Japan is just as wonderful as I thought it was. But it is also just a place, and people there are just as human as anywhere here. And after enough time had passed there, I started to see my home state from a fresh perspective, both in terms of picking up on how a lot of Japanese people thought it was just as exotic as interesting as I had once thought Japan was exotic and interesting. Huh. And also just on an aesthetic level, I started to, it's really interesting. I started to pick up on things that just bounced off me as a kid, because it was normal. I didn't think about them, but like little things like how beautiful the winter sky over the prairie was, or, how striking and unique, like the wind was, when the wind is always blowing and sometimes it's so strong that it makes tornadoes. And it occurred to me, like, this is a unique place, and I haven't seen it authentically captured on film. And I have an opportunity to tell a story that is a fusion of my two homes and is really unique. And that mixed with the practical reality of no one's going to let you make a film until you've made a film. So in order to get out of the catch-22, you have to go to a place where you have friends and resources and goodwill, and had a lot of goodwill from childhood. Now the real happy confluence of events was that the Oklahoma film industry, it's been growing slow and steadily for the past few years, but in the past couple years, it's been taking quantum leaps. And so it was the right time to make a ambitious, unique film in Oklahoma. Because the resources in the state, were aligning with what I wanted to do. And so, I don't know, what do they say? Luck is where preparation meets opportunity. To quote my father, you make your own luck.
Right. Yeah. I mean, why do you think that is? Why has Oklahoma started turning around for that?
Oh, I don't think there's any one answer to these things, but I do. I think there's something to be said about the inferiority complex.
Oh yeah.
As a child, I joke about being bored out of my skull, but like the very concrete thought that I remember over and over again is like, Oklahoma is an insignificant place. Nothing important happens here. I want to work hard to go to a place where important things happen. And of course, ultimately I discovered that that's either not true or at best half true.
Right.
But I think there is some kind of, I don't know if it's a chip on the shoulder or just a drive to work harder and prove something. Because, Oklahoma isn't Tokyo. It isn't New York.
I've seen a couple of, there's a guy who on YouTube who talks about what it's like to live in Tokyo and the good and the bad and all that. And
sure.
What's your favorite part of, living there? You still live there?
Yes, is the short version. The longer version is that COVID upended my life as it did a lot of people. So
right.
I'm in the, I am in a COVID-induced holding pattern where literally my high school yearbooks, dumbbells, and autographed children's books and favorite Godzilla, among other random sundries, are in the care of my best friend back in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. I entrusted them to him in 2019 when I came back to make Geeky Boys and got stranded. I'm being facetious about it, but when the world opens up again, you know, I will head back to Tokyo. It is very much my second home. Mm-hmm. I touched on it there. I mean, the best thing about it is it's my friends. And I think the real gift, it's interesting. I worked very, very hard to become extremely bilingual and extremely fluent.
Yeah.
And the gift of being, because Japan is such a homogenous culture, mm-hmm. the gift of being very fluent in Japanese and very culturally sensitive as a foreigner is you can kind of, at least I've been able to inhabit this kind of, this very specific nether zone where Japanese people will be emotionally vulnerable with me. Mm-hmm. In ways that they wouldn't with another Japanese person. And it also, I mean, because I'm not Japanese, I never will be Japanese. It mm-hmm. means that there's an innate curiosity and I've been able to make friends with people of a lot of different ages who do a lot of different professions. And so really what it comes down to then is it's not about Japanese people or American people. It just means I've been able to connect with a lot of people, in a lot of different walks of life. And I think that is the real reason why Japan has become such a wonderful second home to me, is because it's a place where I've been able to connect with so many great human beings. I will also say it's little odd things like rivers in Japan are beautiful. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a lot of like friendly stray cats along the rivers. So it's a good place to like take a walk and contemplate the world and get, I mean, half of Ike Boys was conceived taking a walk along the Tamagawa, which is, I know that's Kurosawa's favorite river to go fishing on. So, mm-hmm. There is something in the air.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I thought was really well done was how the difference between Sean trying to speak Japanese and understand Japanese and Vic trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Vic is obviously like off close enough and Sean isn't perfect. That's one thing that I think a lot of movies make a mistake of doing is this guy's really smart. I'll go ahead and make him bilingual and he just knows everything, how to say whatever he wants to say.
Yeah.
And in this movie, that's what I found fascinating about it was in the translation, you know, he is saying almost the perfect thing a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And, tell me about that. I mean, obviously it was a conscious thing, but, was that something that was hard to construct when they're speaking Japanese?
I was only able to do it, and I don't think I'm speaking high school, but I say do it very well, because I had years of experience and a long time I was in the phase that Sean was in, which is mm-hmm. the phase that Sean is in is he's studied the books, he's studied the grammar. He has all the knowledge, but he doesn't have the experience to know how to use it in a natural way. So a Japanese listener to it would hear someone who is, it's a bit labored, it's a bit forced, it's very mathematically correct. It's pretty humorously polite. I mean, everything he says is like the most polite possible version of the Japanese.
Yes.
Because he's trying not to offend anyone, he's trying not to make any mistakes. And of course, he makes lots of mistakes. But all of those, frankly, were mistakes I made. Mm-hmm. And Sean will get there, but you have to go through that phase of working really hard and getting a lot of things wrong to get to a phase where things become unconscious. It also speaks to a larger issue of like it's very clear that he's trying really hard.
Yeah.
And I think if there's one message I want to convey with the film, is that trying is really important. It's okay to make mistakes, but if you're really trying to connect with other people and really trying to listen to and understand other people, you'll get pretty far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've gotten about, you know, almost 30 minutes into this interview, and I don't think we've actually talked about, you know, we've kind of gotten around the inspirations of it and everything. Yeah, but tell us about your plot of the movie a little bit. Tell us what this movie's about, and I think people will geek out about it when they find out.
Yeah. Well, no. It's set in the last week of 1999, and yes. It's about a couple of best friends in Oklahoma who they hate Oklahoma. They hate being teenagers, and their escape from the world is all things Japanese and their friendship with one another. Mm-hmm. And in the holidays of 1999, there is a Japanese girl exchange student coming, and for Sean and Vic, these two friends, the arrival of Miki is like winning the lottery. It's like it's a girl and a Japanese girl,
right?
And in their effort to impress her, they track down this mythical long lost masterpiece of Japanese animation that is entitled Go! Exclamation point. Great decisive battle at the end of the century with rainbows. And this film is purportedly a prophecy of the year 1999 and the heroes who will rise up to save the world from destruction. And they all watch this film, and the film curses them, and they slowly but surely transform into the heroes that will save the world. But, of course, in order to do that, they have to reckon with themselves and reckon with who they are and what it actually means to be a hero. And actually, there's a lot of other twists and turns there. That's the primer. Because I haven't even touched on the fact that the reason Miki is in Oklahoma is because she is fascinated by Native American culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is there in search of a deeper understanding of who she is. And all of these things come together in a big, raucous finale that may or may not have actual giant monsters battling.
I was curious about that too. You brought it up, the Native American influence, which by the way, the scene where she tells why she came to Oklahoma in that school was funny on a lot of levels. I mean, obviously the misinterpretation of what kind of Indian Vic was, but also that teacher, I went to a religious based private school. I had that teacher so many times. The awkward, you know, don't really know how to, like, you know, it was a beautiful scene. But I was curious about the Native American influence. I mean, obviously that's a thing in Oklahoma, you know, is that a fascination you have found in Japan? Is that where that came from? Or was it just something that was, it made sense in the story?
Well, so it comes from a couple of different places. So one is growing up, you know, Oklahoma, it's formerly Indian country, mm-hmm. and it's built off of years of cruelty towards Native Americans. And I remember growing up and knowing all of the Native culture that was in the state. And yet I would go to Blockbuster and see Disney films and like films about King Arthur. And I wondered, like, well, wait a minute. Like, why am I not seeing the Native King Arthur here? Like, mm-hmm. why are these the stories that are being told? And it just kind of, on some level, it bothered me that it was all around me. And yet in the day-to-day experience I had, that it was so invisible. And that it was almost like it was something that I was being taught didn't matter and I shouldn't care about. And that really bothered me. And fortunately, we're in a better world now where mm-hmm. I think that's changing, although we still got a ways to go. So that was part of it. And the other is, so Miki, you know, there's a lot of autobiographical elements in this film. There was no Miki who came to my high school, when I was growing up, but Miki's inspired by several of my good Japanese female friends. And the thing about Japan is it's such a homogenous culture that people will tend to get into very specific things and define themselves by their very, very specific passions. I've got one very good friend who there's a whole lot of her in Miki, who her passion in life is traveling the world to photograph ghost towns. So she released a book of photographs of Chernobyl. She actually visited me in Oklahoma, and I never would have even had these places on my radar, but she helped me track down these amazing frontier era ghost towns in Oklahoma.
Wow.
And you know, it's just so this like, you know, Japanese woman my age obsessed with ghost towns around the world. And so it entirely makes sense that there would be someone like Miki who is just like Indians are her thing. Now it's more of a like an idea of Indians rather than the actual reality, and it's like the kind of like skewed information that she would get over in Japan. And so I guess one of the other things I wanted to explore is the fact that like it would be a romanticized and incomplete and inaccurate idea, but it's still something that drives her to find the truth. And again, this speaks to the larger issue of like a lot of the things she thinks proved out to be kind of romanticized or inaccurate or untrue, but she is trying to learn and she's trying to find out. And I guess I really do believe that trying to listen and trying to understand and trying to grow and learn about other perspectives in the world, it makes the world better. And so she doesn't get it all right, but she learns a lot of things and she grows a lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to touch on the special effects in this movie.
Sure.
Because you could easily just say, all right, this is what I planned all along. Or you could say, well, this is because I have a low budget or whatever. I love the special effects in this movie, by the way. So,
Thank you.
I thought that it went totally along with that 90s feel of, you know, when you're watching like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and stuff like that back in the day. So yeah, talk about your special effects, because I think they're fun as well.
Well, and this is something where it's like, it, of course, there's no way I could compete with Marvel resources, but I didn't need to. It was really like, this was the style of special effects that was appropriate for the film. Mm-hmm. And also for me, I mean, it's just like, of course, this stuff was my bread and butter as a child. So, twist my arm to be able to work with the pros and like be in a position to empower and inspire them to do new things in their wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stories I could tell. I think one of my favorites is, you know, so the final battle, it's a big full-on tokusatsu battle. Puppets, men in suits, it's done by crew of Japanese veterans who's worked on, you know, many Godzilla and Gamera films.
Hmm.
And I think my favorite story out of many great stories from working on that is, so, you know, there's a couple of explosions in it, and they're practical explosions, and they were rigged with pyrotechnics and set off something called a shamisen. So shamisen is a Japanese heart, and you lay it out flat and pluck it.
Mm-hmm.
The shamisen and pyrotechnics, it's a wooden board with metal rods on it, and you trigger the rods by hand. And so it's designed so that you can set off the explosions timed real time to what the suit actors are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't go to a store and buy a shamisen. These are all like custom made. And the one we had on Ike Boys operated by a man named Iwata-san, and he had inherited it from his mentor, who had in turn inherited it from the man who built it. And we did the math and like just sort of like traced the lineage of the shamisen, and we're virtually certain that it was built for and used on the very first Godzilla film in 1954.
Oh, wow.
And so like that for me, like, you know, and the explosions, they go by in a blink of an eye, but like the fact that those are not like, those are literally Godzilla explosions. It's like they're not an homage, they're not a love letter, they're not done in the style of, or they're like literally it's there in the DNA. That I, you know, the whole film is an aggregate of details like that, and they consciously, the audience won't register them, but if you put enough care into all the little details like that, it really adds up. Yeah, and I could say all kinds of things. I mean, like, yeah, like, so the kaiju, the fur on that, that's the same fur that was used for the Chewbacca suits. So it's like, there's so much, like, so many little things that, you know, layered on top of one another, they contribute to the whole. And I think what this speaks to is just the joy of working with craftspeople, you know, just like real craftsmen, real people who love their jobs and love their work, and being in a position to elevate and empower them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had, and you had some miniature work in here too, right? Like there's, yes. That's the stuff that gets me excited for some reason. I don't know why. It's something about it. That's just, there's something surreal about seeing miniatures getting blown up, even though it's, you know, in the moment, it obviously it looks exactly like the thing that's being blown up, the full scale size thing that's being blown up. But you like the stuff that's in, there's like a real quick shot in here that just really, I don't know, it transported me to another time. I love stuff like that. I love these little, like, the miniature stuff and everything.
So there's Easter eggs up the wazoo in this film, but if you freeze frame the miniature log cabin, which I think you're talking about,
yeah,
look at it closely, because there is laundry out to dry, multiple empty bottles of moonshine, and a set of ribs over a campfire that look suspiciously like human ribs.
Mm-hmm.
So. There may or may not be drunken cannibals out in the middle of the Oklahoma prairie.
That's like awesome. A whole other side story. That's for the sequel, right? PK Boys 2.
Yeah.
I actually did want to mention real quick, I know we're getting close to the time, but I loved the father-son stuff in this movie. Speaking of Farscape, Ben Browder is excellent in this movie. I really enjoy that. I think in a lot of movies like this, a lot of the times, like when you're dealing with fan culture and stuff, especially with kids, like the parents are typically more dismissive and more just like, you know, come be a man and do this. And, you know, I had a dad like this where, you know, he was a hunter and, you know, stood out by his car on Saturdays with the hood up, drinking beer, listening to the baseball game. I mean, and I'm over there watching horror movies and reading comic books, and he didn't necessarily get it. But 100% supported it and would even, you know, try to do these things with me and stuff like that. So I just thought that was really cool that you kind of capture that type of relationship in this film. So
thank you. I guess, you know, I know we're running out of time here, but I'll say it is so the character of Wayne, of Sean's father, he's a mixture of a childhood friend who is a handyman. And just salt of the earth, good guy. He very much is that person. And there's a little dose of my own father put in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it comes from a real place. And man, Ben Browder, he, like, they say don't meet your heroes, but Ben is just the best. Of course, he's a wonderful actor and a professional, but like, that man just. He's a philosopher. I feel like a couple hours talking with him and all of my problems have been solved.
So he was perfect for that role then.
Indeed.
Unfortunately we're going to have to wrap it up. I had a couple more I wanted to ask about this, cause I really love talking about movies like this, and the process involved and how they're made and everything. But the movie has just played at Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas, and hopefully we'll have some distribution news in the next you know, few days or so. So Eric, thank you for sharing your time today. The movie is The movie is Ike Boys. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.